Accession number 28361, Reel 3.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 3. You were saying that you had to give fire orders when you were practicing the advanced contact on the live firing exercise, and that you sometimes use tracer to indicate.
Yes, the standard drill in those days, I don't know what it is now, is you had two tracers. When you loaded your magazine of 10 rounds in your rifle, the top two rounds were tracer, if you were the section commander. In fact, I think everyone had tracer. So if you didn't see the target, someone else would say, "Watch my tracer." And that indicated where the target was. Yes, everybody had two rounds up the spout, or one up the spout, and the next round was around a tracer.
Mm. Were the sections organised in a normal way, with a Bren group and a rifle group?
Yes, they were. It was the old-fashioned. We didn't have fire teams. We had a rifle group and a Bren group. The Bren group, usually of three, with somebody in charge of it, and a Bren gunner and his number two, and then the rest of the people were the rifle group. Yes.
Was the notional platoon commander allowed to mass his Bren guns? If it seemed to him to be a suitable way of
this came later, and the answer was I don't remember us doing it at that stage. No.
On your batch, did everyone pass out of the commando course?
Yes.
And get through it?
Everyone got through. Mm. Yeah. We got our green berries, and I remember the CEO at Bickley in those days was a chap called Titch Houghton, who is still alive today, actually. But he was a founder member of 40 Commando in 1942, and had been at Dieppe, where he was captured, and then spent the next 3 years giving the Germans a hard time. And you know, one felt very proud to be given the green beret by this man. At the end of the 1 6-week commando course.
So you were then qualified as a marine and as a commander.
Yeah.
What was the next?
Well, the next stage, I thought, was a bit of an anticlimax, because we then went to Portsmouth, where we were introduced to the world of landing craft. Because in those days, the landing craft wing was at Portsmouth and used to operate in the Chichester Harbour area. We used to go out into the Solent quite a lot as well and out to sea. And I found this a bit of an anticlimax, quite frankly, after the excitement of the commando soldiering. And it was that stage where I think I decided I would not go into landing craft and I would avoid going to sea as much as possible. Because I decided that I didn't actually, though I actually enjoyed sailing and mucking around in the water, I didn't actually particularly relish being in a landing craft. And in those days, we had the old LCAs that had been in the war, which were controlled from a little box on the starboard side at the front, where the coxswain, and he had two engine telegraphs back to the engineer, who was shut into a tiny little compartment at the stern of this landing craft, where each side of him he had two, I think they were Ford V8 engines or something, and his job was to obey the telegraphs and put the engines ahead or astern or stop them. And we practiced doing, we were put into all the positions of driving them and being part of the crew and being the chap in the back, though we weren't in charge of it in that sense. We weren't qualified to do it. And we spent a lot of time around in the Solent doing dummy landings on various beaches and so on, but I didn't actually find that terribly interesting. So that was the next stage.
Where were these beaches then?
Well, there are actually quite a lot of beaches, surprisingly enough, in that part of the world. Quite a lot in Langston Harbour's the place I'm thinking of. Langston Harbour, quite a lot of beaches there. There are beaches in places like Browndown and along the coast beyond between Portsmouth and Southampton. There's that stretch of coast there where there are sort of pebble beaches. And then, of course, there are beaches on the Isle of Wight as well. So, I mean, they weren't sort of tactically sound beaches, but they were beaches where you could drive the landing craft on. And
tactically sound.
Tactically sound. You know, they were technically sound, but not tactically sound. So you could learn about not driving it on so hard you couldn't get it off, and learn how to get it off if you did.
I think it was that you weren't attracted by amphibious assault, because it is one of the raison d'etre of the Royal Marines.
I was very happy to be one of the assaulters, but yes. I didn't actually want to be one of the drivers of the landing craft, actually. Though I recognise it's extremely important, but it didn't actually sort of gain my attention, as they say.
How long did that phase last?
That was quite short, as far as I remember, and I think it was only about 4 weeks, by which time it's sort of July.
Yes.
Or so, and then we had some leave, and then we were sent to the bit of training that I didn't enjoy much either, which was going to a carrier to do sea training. And the carrier was HMS Implacable. In those days there were two aircraft carriers, which were Second World War vintage fleet carriers, which were used for seamanship training by the Royal Navy, and they spent most of their time swinging around a buoy in Portland. and so we were sent there, and there we lived in a place called the Midshipman's Chest Flat, which was a space, I suppose, not much bigger than this room.
And how many of you in it?
That's only where that was our day space, where we cleaned our kit, because we were still cleaning our kit. We slept in hammocks in a 5.5 gun battery, which was something like six decks up from the chest flat, because those ships had two twin 5.5 barbettes forward and aft, and another two on each side. So you had altogether eight guns, 5.5 anti-aircraft guns, and they were in these barbettes, which were swiveling turrets, the top of which was flush with the flight deck. And we slung our hammocks in these barbettes.
Had you used a hammock before?
No. So we had to learn how to use a hammock. It was quite an art to it.
How do you use a hammock? What is the central art?
Well, the central art of using a hammock is to have a thing called a stretcher, which stretches the strings, which are not called strings by the Navy, but are called nettles, believe it or not, at each end of your hammock. So that instead of the hammock sort of folding itself around you, it stretches it out and makes it flatter, not completely flat, but flatter. And then the trick is getting into it, of course. So you sling it somewhere where you can grab onto something and pull yourself up into it. And then your blankets, of course, don't tuck in. They hang over the side of the hammock. And you sleep bent all the time. I mean, anyone who's got a bad back, it's an absolute nightmare. And of course, us as sort of 18 and a half, 19-year-olds, it didn't really worry us too much.
You didn't mind being curled up like a comma?
No, but if you were so tired in it, you didn't care. The only advantage of a hammock is when you're in a gale at sea and the thing's swinging about and you're in a reasonably stable condition, and I'll come on to it, we did actually hit a really bad gale when the ship did go to sea. And then the sort of training we did there was rudimentary naval-type seamanship training.
What is seamanship then?
Well, it was sort of taking cutters and whalers away and rowing and sailing them and that sort of thing.
Small boat work.
Yes, that sort of thing. And we were learning about sort of naval customs and habits and generally speaking try to integrate ourselves into the life on board a ship. We used to take part in Sunday divisions every Sunday, where we would be there in our blues and white helmets and everything, more cleaning of course, and march around the deck to the band and do all those sort of things. I actually found it pretty tedious after being the commando training and that sort of thing, and I decided this wasn't for me. Actually, I was not going to be part of a Royal Marine detachment if I could possibly avoid it, and I managed to do just that, I'm happy to say. the enlivening thing, the thing that actually made it worthwhile was when the British Guiana crisis blew up. And we actually had been at sea in an exercise where we hit a huge gale. We had 40 tons of water in the lift well. And I've got a photograph I can show you of this big carrier. She's a big carrier, much bigger than anything we've got at the moment, with half her stern out of the water and water coming in green over the flight deck. And she had two hangars, one above the other. I mean, she was a big ship with an armoured flight deck. And that was quite exciting, that. We then, at the end of that, I remember, put into the Scilly Isles for a visit. I can't imagine why we wanted to take a ship's coming to the Scilly Isles, but we did. And some of the officers were invited ashore to a dance. and so we went in a boat to this dance, because that's the only way we could get there. In those days, we just got our mess kit, which we were rather proud of.
Had you become an officer by
yes,
that stage?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
When did you become an officer?
Well, right from the beginning, you were probationary second lieutenants.
So you weren't cadets?
No, we weren't cadets. We were probationary, so we didn't mean anything. I mean, you were treated just like, you know, ordinary
like Marines.
Mm. By this time, we were sort of being treated more like officers. Mm. And we had our mess kit, which we were very proud of, and we paid quite a lot of money for, about £35 or something in those days. Mm. And we went ashore, in the middle of this dance, a chap rushed in and said, back to the ship. And by which time the weather was beginning to get a bit rough, so we got back to the ship, and I remember being clambering up the side of this ship, up a rope ladder, from this bobbing craft in my mess kit, which was by then covered in spray. And the reason that we were being recalled in such a hurry was twofold. A, because the weather was clamping in, and there was a chance we'd get stranded ashore, but much more important, we were summoned to Plymouth, where we were to pick up the 1st Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders and take them to British Guiana. So we went into Plymouth, and a number of us were assigned to the battalion as sort of LOs between the ship and the battalion, because we were sort of military people, which was great fun. I was attached to one of the companies, I can't remember which one. And the battalion marched behind the pipes and drums from Devonport Station to the ship. And I remember looking at them saying, what a terrific lot of chaps. You know, I want to spend my life soldiering and not sailoring. That sort of was a defining moment in my life. And they came on board and we set sail for the West Indies. And we got there in about a week, because we went there at full speed.
But did the Implacable sail on its own? Or
yes. Oh yes. I mean, there was no threat. There was no naval maritime threat.
Did it have any aircraft embarked?
No aircraft were embarked at all ever on the whole of our time. And they were training ships. They were not capable of taking aircraft. The arrestor wires had been taken away. All the sort of bits and pieces that you expect to have on a carrier had been removed.
And you were saying that, you know, normally you're very tired and you got into your hammock, so you're all right. But what was it they were doing with you that was making you so tired in the period when you were just
I suppose we were just... there was quite a lot of fresh air. There was a bit of, you know, boat work made you reasonably tired. We did a bit of PT. When I say we were tired, we were not exhausted. Mm. But we were, I suppose, you know, young chaps who were... tired by the time it was bedtime.
And how did you get on with the Navy? Did you find them?
Well, I found them rather strange, actually. The immediate contemporaries on board were people called aviation cadets. Mm. The Navy at that stage was finding problems with getting enough air crew for the Fleet Air Arm, which was quite big in those days.
Yes.
This is 1953 you were talking about. Do you want to stop while that rings? The Navy still had a pretty big fleet arm in those days, and they weren't getting enough volunteers from the regular Navy, so they introduced a system of naval aviation cadets, where they recruited straight from civil life, and then they were going to train them as observers or pilots, because there was actually quite a high casualty rate in the fleet arm in those days. Anyway, they were our immediate contemporaries in terms of age and so on, and we used to eye each other somewhat suspiciously, we used to call them rude names like the AVCADs and things like that, But on the whole, I think discretion was a better point, and they left us alone on the whole. I found naval officers very different from marine officers. They were far more rank conscious. And also, I think, too, that the quality on board the ship was not all that not necessarily all that high. And some of them were chaps who'd probably done very well in the war and very gallant, but they were, I think, a bit past it. And I don't think their heart was in the Navy, quite frankly. And that showed. The outstanding man was the captain, a chap called Campbell, who was a brilliant seaman. And during that gale I described to you, a sailor got washed over the off the quarterdeck. He was a lifebuoy sentry on the quarterdeck, and so it gives you an indication of how rough the sea was. This was a carrier. The sea came through the quarterdeck and just swung him over the side. And I'll show you afterwards a picture of what the seas were like to give you an idea of what happened.
Where was this? Was this Mid-Atlantic?
This was out in the bay, out in the Atlantic. Bay of Biscay.
Ah, yes.
On this exercise I was talking about. And we thought that's it. You know, there's no way. He'd want a boat. And what he did was the bosun went out onto the cable deck, which is the front end of a carrier, but not on the top.
It's underneath.
It's underneath, mm-hmm. therefore nearer the water. And was ready, had a rope tied round him, was ready to be lowered over the side. And the captain brought this huge carrier down onto this man as if he was picking up a boy in a harbour. And the bosun was lowered over the side and grabbed him, and he was pulled back in. It was the most amazing piece of seamanship.
Sounds extraordinary that he'd be able to spot the man.
Well, he did it.
Really
He did it. It was quite astonishing. I mean, that was an outstanding piece of seamanship. So you had this sort of very dynamic captain, but at a lower level, some of the officers I thought were not as good as one would expect, and they certainly weren't up to the standard of naval officers nowadays. Some of them were a bit sort of bombed out, I think, is how one would describe them.
Did you find that they had different? You said they were rank conscious. How did that show itself?
They didn't seem to have the same rapport with the sailors as I would have expected officers to have with marines and soldiers. And this was very much emphasised when you saw the Argylls come on board, and there was the sort of relationship you'd expect between the officers and the jocks, which seemed to me to be slightly different than that between naval officers and ratings. They were still very old-fashioned, it seemed to me. I mean, I may be wrong. This is an 18-and-a-half-year-old talking.
But one interesting thing is that it seems to me that in your training as an officer at a very early stage, you were mixed in with Marines under training. Whereas in both the Army and the Navy, that doesn't happen, that officers are trained in separate establishments, hardly ever encounter a rating or a soldier until they're actually sent to their first posting as a commissioned officer.
Yes, this was a difference. Now, whether it was by design or by virtue of the fact that being such a small corps with a tiny body of potential officers, you obviously you can't afford to set up a sort of Sandhurst for 14 people. You do it in the training organisation you've got, and therefore,
yes,
by circumstance, you tend to mix in with the guys anyway.
Of course, at this time, when there's still national service going on, many officers would have started out as national service men, and they'd have done recruit training with the other ranks. I don't think the Navy ever did that.
Yes, they did. Well, I don't know. Yes, they did. The Navy did it. They had a scheme, and the Marines did it. We had quite a lot of national service officer. When I say we had 30% national service,
yes.
I mean my two contemporaries at school, in fact my left and right prop in the Sherburn First 15, both joined the Royal Marines as national servicemen. So they were doing, they did 12 weeks training as other ranks. They then went and did the, what was then called, I think, the WASBE, the War Office Selection Board, with their army chums. And then they went to Eton Hall for 4 months, and then they came back to the Royal Marines, if they came back to the Royal Marines, and not all of them did. I mean, some had to go elsewhere because there wasn't room for them in the Royal Marines. But two of my greatest friends now, in fact, the chap who was my deputy brigade commander many, many years later, started life as a National Service Marine and went to Eton Hall and all that sort of thing. So there were National Service Marine officers, yes. Not many Navy National Service, quite a tiny amount, but there were some.
Mm. Well, I'm thinking more in terms of quite a lot of officers who are going to become regulars joined in the ranks and did their basic...
Oh, yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Going off to Sandhurst later.
They did. In fact, I think they all had to in those days. I know my friends who went to Sandhurst, my contemporaries, went to the ranks for 12 weeks first. I think it was a very good idea. I mean, I've always thought that's a good idea. In fact, when I was running Royal Marine Training, I suggested that we did that as well. It never came about. Mm. I think it was a very good idea.
Mm. So you had a storm, that the man overboard was recovered, and you were on your way to British Guiana.
Yes.
What happened when you actually got to British Guiana?
Well, we never got there. We unloaded the ship in Trinidad because the ship was too big to go into British Guiana, and so we transferred all the jocks to a repulsive looking coaster. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a really dirty looking ship, and we felt rather sorry for the jocks having to go to this wretched thing, but it was only going to be about a day, I think, on board. So we unloaded them, and those days they had Bren gun carriers and things like that, and these were all heaved over the side and pushed into this other ship. And we then went to Trinidad.
Did the carrier have derricks?
Yes.
Other means
to yes, and also this ship, and I can't remember the name of it, was a merchant ship. She had derricks as well, so the Bren gun carriers could be picked up and
swung
over the side and plumbed down into the hold of this dreadful ship. We then went into Trinidad, where we had a tremendous bonus, because as far as we were concerned, in our training, we were never going to go near the West Indies. We had a most wonderful visit there, where we went ashore and swam in the local club and drank rum and lime and met some of the local girls, because there was quite a big British community there in those days, and had lovely parties. And then that was about 3 or 2 days, and then the ship which had taken the jocks to British Guiana returned, and bearing with it the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, 23rd of Foot, who were the resident battalion in Jamaica, who had been the first people to go there. The jocks relieved them, allowing them to go back to Jamaica, and they came on board, and again we were attached to companies, and I was attached to a company which I can't remember the company commander, but I remember the company sergeant major, because he eventually became the RSM at the Staff College, where of course I met him. He was like a lot of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers from Birmingham. A wonderful man, and the Fusiliers all slept in the hangar of this carrier on those camp beds, those low camp beds, you know, the ones that are about
metal legs,
and they're about 6 inches off the ground. And every morning, of course, the company sergeant major and the company commander and me, as the sort of LO to the ship, would go on the rounds of the barrack space while the Fusiliers were on deck doing PT and other things. And I remember that the sergeant major saw a tobacco tin underneath one of these camp beds. You remember the sort of tins that cigarettes used to come in, tobacco, which offended his sense of propriety. So he put a finger into it to hook it out, and leapt back, and hanging from the end of his finger was a tiny crocodile that this Fusilier had obviously acquired in British Guiana and was keeping a tin under his bed. And anyway, he eventually, I think, he threw it over the side. But that stuck in my mind ever since. And we landed the Fusiliers in Jamaica, and then we had another fun couple of days in Jamaica.
How did the Fusiliers compare in their habits and ways of doing things and thinking with the Argyll and Southern Highlanders?
They were totally different. The Argylls actually were rather scruffy, and this wasn't their fault. It was because they had been issued with their khaki drill, and the shorts didn't fit them very well, and the shirts didn't fit them very well, and they had no opportunity to sort of go to the tailor and have them sharpened up. The Dobie facilities on the ship weren't all that bright either, so they looked rather scruffy, but they were a tough crowd, great fun. The Royal Welsh Fusiliers, of course, had been in the West Indies for quite a long time, so they had immaculately pressed shorts, and they looked terribly sort of neat. and their white hackles in their berries, and they were more reserved than the Jocks, but I think both very good battalions. Well, you know, they're both full of spirit, but they were totally different from each other. There was a more free and easy atmosphere in the Argylls, actually. And of course, the Argylls and the Royal Marines, because of operated together in Malaya in 1942 in Singapore, had an affinity, which was another reason why we regarded them in a special way. That's the Royal Marines did. Right, so we then went to Jamaica and had another couple of days jolly ashore.
I'd like to go back a bit, actually. Something just occurred to me, that when you were doing your first 6 months of basic training, was there a sort of social programme for recreation and entertainment as part of the training process? Yes. Formal dining and things like
that? Yes, we did formal dining. We're encouraged to do Scottish country dancing, for example, which was very much in the vogue at the time.
Cross-country dancing.
and we were invited to people's houses and that sort of thing. So there was entertainment, yes. I mean, not much, but there was some.
And did that progressively increase as you went through the training? Was there more?
Not really, no. I mean, we attended more dinner nights and things like that. I mean, once we'd sort of got our mess kit and that sort of thing, we attended dinner nights and we were... There was much more taking part in the social life of wherever we were, like balls and cocktail parties. In fact, one of the things that was a particular aspect, of course, was this trip to the West Indies, was the Navy in their traditional style threw cocktail party at every port. Mm. And we were involved in that, looking after people and hosting. So that was very much part of the scene, yes.
What about the drinking on the basic training and beyond? Was there a policy on drinking, and was there a lot of drinking going on?
Oh, yes. I mean, we drank in the evenings. The only thing that limited our drinking was our pockets. We couldn't afford. We got paid very little. We got paid the same as cadets, basically. Mm. And I think for the first 6 months, then our pay went up, which wasn't much. So you couldn't afford to have a huge sort of night on the town every night. Weekends at Limpson, most of us acquired either cars or motorbikes, and we'd go into Exeter and, you know, take our girlfriends out and on a Saturday night. In those days, you used to work on Saturday mornings until midday, and then so you had Saturday off, and then you were back for church on Sunday, so you didn't actually have much time off.
So cocktail parties around the West Indies,
yes.
Trinidad, Jamaica.
Yes, and then we went to Barbados. I'm not quite sure why we went to Barbados. There was no operational reason for doing so. I suspect the captain just wanted to go there, which was the most fun of all, where we had another cocktail party and we swam and sort of swam. We didn't scuba dive, but we swam with, you know, snorkels and masks and that sort of thing, and had a super time, and then headed for home.
This is your training cruise. How long was it overall?
Well, overall, we joined. I suppose it would have been the beginning of what one would call the Christmas term. So it's sort of September 1953 now, and we finished in about the end of November 53. That, and then we started what was the final phase of our training, which was back at Limpston again, and was really to train us to be platoon commanders or troop commanders.
Mm. Troop commanders course, then, one might call that. What did that involve learning?
It was very like the platoon commanders course at Warminster, quite frankly, which we did as well later. but you were being trained how to run a troop or platoon. You were also trained one up at sort of company level as well, and you did toots at commando level. So you, the training consisted of toots, classroom instruction, model exercises, covering all the phases of war, advance, withdrawals, defence, advanced contact, fighting in built-up areas, all those sort of things. More radio training, exercises, two quite big exercises with troops.